We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences. So the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Just go to Indeed.com/Blue Wire right now and support our show by saying that you heard about Indeed on this podcast. That's Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Late to you today, but it's not our fault. Spain just won't stop scoring. This is the Arsenal Vision World Cup Daily. My name is Elliot Smith. You can follow me on Twitter, Yankee Gunner. What a day. What an interesting day. What I'm curious about is how the Belgium result is going to impact Ghana's chances to finish top in their group, and especially how the Germany result is going to impact England and whether they can top the group. I'm joking. If you don't get it, it's because, like a dummy, I had all this advanced analysis yesterday of how results were going to impact groups that the teams weren't even in together. And Phil didn't correct me, so we'll blame Phil. Please send all the hate to Phil on Twitter, and we'll give you his handle in just a moment. But we did correct it, and we are here to discuss a really, really fun day in the World Cup, I thought, and here to do it now is Phil Costa. You can find him on Twitter @_PhilCosta. Hello, Phil Costa.
Hello, Elliot. Good to know that everyone was listening and on their toes. They passed the test, which is ultimately the most important thing.
It's super disappointing because I really have always believed the point of the podcast was to be background noise while you do things like, you know, wash your car or go for a jog or, you know, walk the dog and pick up poop, but not to really listen to it. But people apparently really listen to it. So who knew? Especially when Clive's not on. He will be on some of these, by the way. And finally, making his debut, feeling better and with us to discuss a heck of a day, a man who lives in Germany and so therefore is, I'm sure, caught up with the zeitgeist in Germany at the moment with a result that no one will be thankful for, is Lewis. You can find him on Twitter @LGAmbrose. Hello, Lewis.
Hi, crawling off my sickbed because I know all of the groups like the back of my hand, and I heard that that was needed around here.
I mean, knowing literally anything would be a step above what I have contributed to the World Cup Daily so far, but because you are here now, I don't have to know anything. I just have to be witty, so still no value added, unfortunately. Let's get into this, and I think we should go in order of interest, which is a difficult one because they were three of the four games that were really, really interesting. But Lewis, I'll start with you since you are in Germany. Germany, they're not the Germany that we maybe grew up remembering as, you know, this organized, defensively stalwart team that just ruthlessly and efficiently crushed the opposition. They were beaten, and I think at least in the second half, fairly beaten, deservedly beaten, by a really interesting Japan team that seemed to keep their powder dry until halftime and then unleash their great players like Takehiro Tomiyasu. So what are your thoughts, your headline, so to speak, from Japan 2, Germany 1?
Yeah, Germany are just like a bad version of Spain now, mostly. Lots and lots of possession, no obvious goal scorer, nobody to rely on for goals and clinical finishing, and then get caught out on the counterattack. It's like a classic bad Spanish performance. With a caveat, it wasn't that bad. Germany had loads of chances, and I think, you know, this podcast especially, and listeners to this podcast are very familiar with the idea that, you know, if a team plays well more often than not, they will win games, and more often than not, Germany would have won this game. The number of chances they had, you know, either side of halftime. Unfortunately, as we all know, if you don't finish those chances, you are going to leave yourself wide open to being sucker punched. And Japan did really, really improve and grow into the game. Thought they had a goal this lab really early on, but after that they had very, very little to offer in the first half. And the start of the second half was much the same. But they went, like, credit to them and to the coach as well, because they absolutely went for it, like kitchen sink. They ended up with, at halftime, as you say, Tomiyasu came on at halftime and he actually came on for a winger and they switched to a back five. But then they changed both of the wing backs for forwards, ostensibly. They changed the striker. They threw another attacking midfielder on in an ex-Liverpool man, Takumi Minamino. And Germany just couldn't handle it, the number of bodies that were going forward in the opposite direction. So, yeah, with a one goal lead, maybe they should have been a bit more sensible when Japan started throwing things at them. Instead, the gaps were there at the back and they didn't really know how to handle it. And now, I mean, when you look at the group, and that is the group, obviously, with Spain in it, that was the game.
Thanks for the knowledge. There you go. See, Phil, see how it's done.
but that was the game. And I think Manuel Neuer said it after the game on TV over here. It was like, this is the game that he was looking at that they had to win, or the game that they couldn't lose. This was the really big one. I don't think it's the best sign of the mental state of the team when they've just lost a game and the captain, the most experienced player, goes on national TV and goes, yeah, this is the one game we couldn't afford to lose, instead of trying to say, let's move on to the next one and win on Sunday and put right the wrongs. But no, he's not wrong. And Germany now, I think, are in massive, massive trouble. They're probably going to have to win both games, which obviously means beating Spain on Sunday, which is very difficult to see happening right now.
Yeah, I mean, you would say, well, Japan played brilliantly, but they're not a guarantee to win any game. But the way Costa Rica looked, Japan are going to be a huge, huge favorite now to beat Costa Rica. And Costa Rica certainly won't feel like they have a hell of a lot to play for after the humiliation they suffered, but maybe pride will be enough. But yeah, I mean, if Germany don't not just get a result, but beat Spain, I think they're probably out then. And that is not a position anyone would have expected two games into the tournament. You do not want to be the first team eliminated from the World Cup if you can avoid it. And they are now well on track to potentially have that happen. Phil, so firstly, we should say Arsenal legend, Takuma Asano with a beautiful goal. Are we claiming that as an Arsenal goal? Where are we at with that?
Mr. Wenger's done it again. That's where I stand.
Done it again.
Yeah. He's done it again. That smile, that damn smile.
What do you think of the goal?
Lots to talk about there. I mean, first of all, it's a brilliant piece of individual play. I mean, he's plucked it out. He's put it in his stride. He's put it in literally the only square he can get it into, past Manuel Neuer, straight into that top corner. In terms of what Asano's done, it's brilliant. But the German defensive line, Zula's way too deep.
Was it Schlotterbeck? Was it Zula? What the heck is going on?
Zula was way too deep. Rudiger and Schlotterbeck were too far apart. Schlotterbeck doesn't even look to see where Asano is. Mm-hmm. And it's just a mess. I mean, Lewis kind of nailed it. He said, in the first half, David Raum was just getting in on that left-hand side every single time. And I'm like, why is this coach not doing anything about it? He's not reacting to anything. And then what happens in the second half? He's the most reactive coach I've ever seen. Mm. Bringing on Mitoma, Ritsu Doan, Minamino, Tomiyasu. When you look at the squad, it's a really good squad. And I love Japan, because the cliche is often that they're hardworking, industrious players, honest players, but the technical quality is really high. And they were just beating the press with little 1-2s, little triangles. They were really comfortable in small spaces, working things around the box. And I just think it turned into a basketball match with Germany didn't want, because in the first half, Gundogan was just running everything. I mean, he was just running the whole game. But like you said, if you don't take your chances, this can happen. And Japan were growing, and they took their chances, and Germany didn't really have any time to respond.
International football is weird though, Phil, because like if this were an Arsenal game, I'd probably be pointing to the XG, right? I'd probably be pointing to the stats. I'd be saying 75% possession, 26 shots.
Trust the process.
We didn't deserve this. And I have to admit, I was more focused on the second half than the first, partly because Tomiyasu was on, but also just the way it timed out with my day. And as someone who concentrated more on the second half, Japan did not feel an unworthy winner to me. But is this a case of scoreline dictating reaction, in the sense that like a couple of moments of really poor German defending and some Japan finishing obscures the fact that Germany were the dominant side and could still turn up against Spain. And, you know, maybe where they're not required to press the issue as much, if they can be a little organized and counter, could get something. I mean, is there more life to Germany than maybe we're giving credit for just because of the scoreline here?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely.
Sorry. Not you, Lewis. When we need actual information, we'll come to you. This is just opinion stuff right now.
Look, you can't rule them out. And I think a lack of a recognized striker does hurt them. I still don't really know where Havertz is playing or what he's best at. And I was screaming at Hansi Flick to get Musiala more central because he was kind of playing too wide.
Yeah.
And for 55 minutes, they were dominant. But you could slowly see Japan coming into the game, growing into the game. And like you said, they couldn't turn around that momentum. I don't know how Lewis saw it, but from where I was standing, it was a tale of two halves.
Lewis, I mean, some of that is Japan making the changes to bring on their best players and play the second half to win. Some of that is Germany being profligate with the dominance and the shots they had. And then I do think it's interesting that he changes Musiala and Müller and Gnabry and Havertz. And like, did he bring on better players who were more likely to turn the game, or did he just make changes to make changes? So how do you look at how the game was managed by Flick?
I think it was one of those situations when you get into a bit of a funk with the momentum where it just becomes really hard to control and turn back around. They didn't sub on Dross.
Can I ask you a question just because I don't know?
Müller. Go.
Is Sané fit or just not good anymore?
No, he's out. I don't know if he'll be fit at the weekend, but he pulled up in training with a knee injury.
Okay, because I didn't know that because I was surprised not to see him. Come on, he was on the bench. So
yeah, so yesterday he got a knee injury, or the day before he got a knee injury in training. But, you know, one of the topics then in Germany after the game was, well, from Bastian Schweinsteiger, who was on TV, who, by the way, Jesus, don't listen to anything he has to say. But he mentioned, like, you know, Goretzka didn't start. It's like, but, you know, Gundogan did start. So, sure, there's not really a bad choice between the two of them. He also mentioned that Thomas Müller came off. Thomas Müller hasn't really played for 2 months. There was a question about whether or not he was even going to be in the squad because he's not played for 2 months for Bayern Munich. He's not kicked a ball. I was actually quite surprised, or a little bit surprised, to see him start after so long without football. So, you know, they brought on Jonas Hofmann, who's played a lot for Germany the last couple of years, really been trusted by Hansi Flick. Then they needed a goal. They brought on the two natural strikers in the squad, but one of them's a 29-year-old who before last week had never played for Germany, and one of them turned 18 at the weekend and had never played for Germany until last week. So, it's the striker situation, believe it or not, without Timo Werner, is far from ideal and far from obvious, and then it's a matter of trying to fit in attacking midfielders. Like, yeah, that's why, as Phil said, you had Kai Havertz up front, which, I mean, for me, Germany at the weekend just played Niklas Füllkrug. He's 29, he's big, he's uncomfortable, and he will not let the Spain centre-halves rest. Or play Youssoufa Moukoko, who is 18 and has all the running and energy in the world and gets shots away like nobody's business. At the end of the day, both of them are strikers, and Kai Havertz isn't, not a proper one anyway.
If the Spain game is any indication, Germany may have the chance to play a bit more on the counterattack too. So you wonder, would you opt to play someone who can run a bit up front? You know, can you play Musiala as a striker? Can you play Gnabry? I don't know. Havertz, I'm not really sure anybody knows what Havertz is, least of all Chelsea. They continue to try to start him up front. And the thing I think is interesting is Havertz may lose his place here in Germany and may come home to find he's lost his place to Cristiano Ronaldo at Chelsea. So that ought to be fun when that happens. So, all right, well, let's set that game aside. It definitely leaves Japan poised to go through by beating what looks like a dreadful Costa Rica. I read a tweet. I retweeted it. I think it's right. Costa Rica are a team that qualifies for these tournaments and makes noise in CONCACAF by virtue of having a very uniquely phenomenal home pitch, home stadium advantage in CONCACAF. As a CONCACAF watcher, you go and you play on some weird pitches and in some unique places. In qualifying, and Costa Rica make the most of that for sure. They have some talent. They have Joel Campbell. He got out while he still could. But it was a pretty humiliating day for the Costa Rican team. And let's just put this into context, Phil. Costa Rica took zero shots. Now, I want to wind back the clock. Once upon a time, Arsenal trying to get past Barcelona in the Champions League, went to the Nou Camp and scored the opening goal and had a 1-0 lead against Barcelona, having taken no shots. It was an own goal from a corner kick, and we were leading Pep's Barcelona team 1-0 with no shots. Having said that, I would not advocate no shots as a tactic. They coupled that with 18% possession. This was probably the most dominant game I've ever seen in my life, certainly in international football. Can you ever remember a team being outclassed in the way that Spain outclassed Costa Rica? And well, I remember include that Brazil-Germany game, but, you know, this was something else.
I remember that game with the Nou Camp very clearly, and Nicolas Bentner should have put us through at the end.
He should have, yes. Was that also the game where Van Persie got sent off for the kicking after the whistle, or is that a different trip to the Nou Camp?
Yeah. It's the same one.
Same one, yeah.
It was, right. So fun game for us. I mean, look, Spain were obviously the clear favourites going into this game, but Costa Rica offered, you know, zero resistance. I mean, they started with three defenders, two wing backs, and the idea with that is that defensively you can make it, you know, difficult for your opponent, but it was just not difficult at all. And the thing is, under Luis Enrique, I find Spain quite hot and cold. But he made a few interesting tactical tweaks today, you know, that really put the game in their favor. I think Rodri at center back had a few eyebrows raised before kickoff. But look, ultimately, they knew they were going to dominate the ball. It was just another avenue for distribution from deep. And then that allowed Pedri and Gabi to push forward as eight. So they completely boxed Costa Rica in. And from that moment, you could see Spain knocking the ball around, little 1-2s, you know, switching the ball under no pressure. And from there, you knew it was going to be a long afternoon. I mean, Asensio, another interesting tactical switch at false nine. I mean, he was the false nine on the team sheet, but he wasn't really. I mean, in that first half, Dani Olmo was playing as the false nine. Ferran Torres was playing as the false nine. I mean, it's classic Spain. This was typical Spain. And often in recent years, they haven't looked like typical Spain, but today that was the blueprint. That's what we've become to know, what we've become familiar with. You know, look where all the goals were scored. Olmo was playing as a center forward when he scored. Ferran Torres, second goal, he's in the 6-yard box. You know, Asensio on the edge of the box tapping in for his one. So they just got as many good players forward as possible, which in my books is going to get you some goals, and it got them 7. So look, it wasn't pretty. They were heavy favorites, but this was, you know, they look ominous, let's just put it that way.
It was a disgusting display from Costa Rica. I mean, come on, you can't get more than 18% of the ball. The thing that was crazy was just they gave it back every time they had it. I mean, just the speed with which Spain regained the ball, and Luis, this is Spain as you knew them. I mean, total control, can't get past them. And oh, by the way, you blink, and here's another golden generation, right? I mean, here's another generation of Pedri and Gavi and Ferran Torres. And on the bench, by the way, Ansu Fati, what's Ansu Fati, 17 years old or something? Something like that. I don't know facts, as everybody knows. Jeremy Pino, Carlos Soler comes off the bench and makes an impact. This is a Spain team that was probably not regarded as highly as they should, at least not in things I read. And I'm curious if we could be looking at the next golden generation coming to the fore already right now.
Yeah. I mean, like, I don't think we should understate how awful Costa Rica were as well. They did not make it hard because, you know, we've seen teams of holy levels, but the opposition would just come and play 5-4-1 and make life really, really hard to break them down. Costa Rica just didn't do that at all.
You know, every cutback in the box looked like it could have scored a goal. Like they had no answer for a cutback. I don't understand what they were doing.
Out wide, the movement in the middle. Busquets had... I thought Busquets was fantastic. He looked like, you know, his best from 4 or 5, 6 years ago. But the amount of time and space that he had was just ridiculous.
There was some lovely skill, though, involved. I mean, was it Gabby's finish, the outside of the right boot?
Yeah, was it? Off the post.
Yeah, that's sensational.
What strikes me with the way Spain played today compared to sort of classic Spain, and maybe compared to the Euros last year, I thought the Euros last year, they were probably the best team at the competition. Mm. The goals were missing, but they were to watch as well, not just the way that they played. I thought they were great to watch last summer. And Spain had lost that for quite a while. They'd sort of 2008 was exciting. 2010, they started to bore people to tears. And it was like packing so many midfielders into the team. And, you know, we've seen Spain 10 years ago now win trophies with, you know, Iniesta on the wing, Cesc as a forward. And it's like, right, okay, you're playing five or six central midfielders at some point. And then it would be like David Villa on one flank or Pedro on one flank. And that was it. That was the difference today for me and why they played so much faster when they got to the final third. They were not playing five central midfielders today. The names Phil mentioned, Marco Asensio, Dani Olmo, Ferran Torres, these guys are all wingers or second strikers. None of them's number nine, like a real center forward, but they're all guys that want to get on the end of things, want to get in the box, want to run off the shoulder. And to add to that sort of control, obviously you get the extra midfielder in the team, as Phil mentioned, by having Rodri at center back. To have that control, that sort of Spanish style of play with Busquets, with Gavi, with Pedri, but then to have a front three who all want to interchange position and run beyond the last man and get on the end of things as well, is a deadly, deadly mixture.
Yeah. I guess, Phil, the only question about this is, I don't think there's any hope for Costa Rica, so let's not even discuss them. It's hard to evaluate. If you had to move a slider where all the way on one side is Spain are the best team that's ever played football, and all the way on the other is Costa Rica is the worst team that's ever played football, and that's how we're evaluating this game, where is the slider? How much of this is an ominous warning sign to the rest of the tournament about Spain's young revolution coming for them, and how much of it is you put a half-decent team up against this Costa Rica and they're going to batter?
Yeah, I'm going to be firmly in the middle here because, look, I said Spain were very impressive on the day. I thought they were sharp. Their pressing was good. Technical security was good. I mean, as we said, this was classic Spain. And I really enjoyed a few tactical switches from Luis Enrique. But, you know, Costa Rica were just never in this game from the first minute, first whistle. You know, Spain were already on the attack straight away. And some of that defending in the second half was just embarrassing. Not tracking runners. You know, there was one cross. I think it was Jordi Alba crossing the ball into the box. And both centre-backs who were close to the ball just didn't jump. They just didn't jump. And it was just like, what is happening here? You know, this is the World Cup. You're playing for your country. And we've seen already how it can work in your favor, how teams can get up for these occasions. Saudi Arabia, Tunisia, you know, banging their chests for every interception, every block. And this was just the complete opposite of that. And it was embarrassing, really. And even with a quality goalkeeper like Keylor Navas in goal, they still held seven. So look, they're not going to score seven again in the tournament. I'm pretty confident about that, but it's not a bad way to start.
By the way, when they won it in 2010, they only scored eight in the entire competition, with, you know, a couple of extra times thrown in there as well. It's mad.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, all right. So, I mean, Lewis, last thing on this group. You can't rule. I mean, Germany, by the way, it's not like they were battered, right? We already discussed the metrics. The one downside for Spain is they've just had it very easy. They probably played 80 minutes of this game at a canter, 70 minutes of it. Do you think that maybe playing a game like this, whereas Germany really got pushed by a very good Japan and, you know, have everything to play for, and Spain will be feeling very, very confident, but they're also very young. Do you think it could, in a way, work against Spain, that they now have to really focus and really take a beaten Germany very seriously, or risk, I think, being shocked themselves? Not that Germany beating Spain would be a shock, but you know what I'm driving at here.
Yeah. I don't think Spain will be too concerned, or I don't think Spain have too much to worry about, because they obviously, not that they should take it lightly at all, but they have the last group game against Japan the one after, next week. So even if something goes wrong against Germany, Spain will have the chance to redeem themselves and have that one-off game at the end. The question is, what Germany can do. And if Germany can show up, like you said, obviously they'll have less of the ball. They'll have the chance to break into space. They'll have the chance to win the ball high up the pitch and press Spain. That would be really interesting. It'll play more into Germany's hands. It'll obviously be a much, much bigger test for Spain, and we'll probably, I think often these tournaments, when the quality between teams is, you know, Costa Rica, yeah, rubbish. But we also have nothing to compare them against, because we haven't seen Spain against anybody else. So, or we haven't seen them play anybody else. So Sunday will tell us a lot, I think, about both teams. I wouldn't back Germany to qualify now, but I also wouldn't be surprised at all if they turned up and played really well and got the 3 points. And then we went into the last game of the group and you had Germany, Spain and Japan all fighting to qualify.
Yeah, well, it'll be very interesting. Well, it's amazing that we're almost a half hour into this already, and we're just now getting to what might have been the most entertaining fixture of the tournament. Like, I loved the Belgium-Canada game. I don't know if everyone's going to agree with me there. Canada, I mean, a lot depends on the source you get for your XG. Canada lose 1-0 with a 2.83 to 0.86 XG victory over Belgium. But that's not to say Belgium didn't have openings. De Bruyne, I thought, pretty poor, you know, didn't have his most precise day passing the football. The stats are just utterly fascinating and tell a story of the game. 22 shots for Canada as well to just 9 for Belgium. They really went at them. They had a penalty saved. They had another penalty not given, and I cannot for the life of me understand it. It was given offside by a linesman who clearly doesn't understand the rules, and the only thing I'm guessing is the offside being given then does not allow them to go check the penalty, right? Because they can't say it's onside because they blew the whistle.
Didn't blow until afterwards as well. Like, so they, right. So the flag went up after
wrongly.
So that, mm-hmm. So they could have still given the penalty. So gave offside after levels. The foul. Yeah, and then there was a former ref on German TV, and she said who used to ref in the Bundesliga, and she said that basically they wouldn't overturn it because the defender got a touch on the ball before standing on I don't know who the forward was. Was it Buchanan?
Yeah.
But the defender basically got a touch on the ball before standing on Buchanan's foot. For me, that, like, if that's how the rules work, then the rules are wrong and they should be changed, because, you know, the defender barely touches the ball and then clearly stands on his foot, and the Buchanan can't move anymore, and obviously goes down. For me, that, if that's the reason it wasn't a penalty, it definitely should be one. I don't even think that was the only one. There was one that Axel Witsel stood on, like a kind of similar challenge, but nowhere near the ball. I think Canada were really unlucky not to end that first half with 3 penalties.
I mean, yeah, and Belgium just looked old trying to defend. They could not live with the counterattack from Canada. Jonathan David, we know he can be difficult on counterattack. Alphonso Davies, obviously one of the best players in the world, full stop, just a great player, caused them all kinds of problems. Canada were tremendously profligate. There were a number of pullbacks that didn't quite find the man by a foot, right? Some shots that were well saved, but also some poor finishing. I think it's fair to say there was one cross where it was skied over the bar from close range. And at the other end, I mean, Kevin De Bruyne, at one point, there's a 3-on-2 counterattack for Belgium. He's got an easy reverse ball to Tielemans that, if he's playing in a Manchester City shirt, I have no doubt he finds it. Instead, he goes the other direction and nothing comes from it. The goal Batshuayi scores is definitely a worthy game-winning goal. Over the top, pulls it right down, finishes it beautifully. But for me, Phil, this game was all about Canada, their quality, their counterattack, their profligacy, and it sets up for a very interesting group now, because, I mean, with Morocco and Croatia drawing a pretty dull game, Canada's definitely very much alive in this, and I would still expect them to go through. But so how do you have this? Do you have this as Canada blowing it, basically? Because I have a hard time seeing it any other way, or is it the ref that gets all the blame?
I think it's a combination of everything. I don't think you can expect Canada to be to be the ones blowing it, having not beaten Belgium. But like you said, I think they had more than enough chances to win this game, and Belgium looked very, very old, particularly playing 3 at the back. with Alderweireld and Vertonghen. I mean, they've got an average age of nearly 70, but you know, a combined age, sorry, of nearly 70.
I was going to say, I knew they were old, but man, time is flying.
Yes, it's been 84 years. No, it's
both play in Belgium now as well.
Yeah, and it was, you know, you could see them playing in a back three and covering space, and it's just not what they want to do. But they were just killing them in transition. I mean, even in midfield, Axel Witsel is not what he used to be. And I was really enjoying Canada's performance. I think there was a couple of players in particular. I mean, Estacio, is that how you pronounce his name? I thought he was brilliant in that first half. Mm-hmm. Buchanan as well really impressed me. I think actually, if it was two Canada players I would single out who weren't maybe at the level, it would be Alphonso Davies and Jonathan David. I mean,
to be fair, yeah.
Davies did not look comfortable at all stepping up for that penalty, and I think he took it more out of a feeling of responsibility as opposed to being the best option.
Can I ask you a question? Is it very different from the one Lewandowski took? Really? It's firmly struck
it's
in a comfortable, because I haven't seen Lewandowski get too much of a hammering for the penalty he struck. I think they're the same penalty, just to different sides.
Yeah, it struck well, but it's just too central. And when you're playing against Thibaut Courtois, you need to put it right in the corner because he covers 95% of the goal.
Yeah.
And it was just unfortunate because I was really impressed with their pressing. I thought they showed a lot of energy in the first half, and I just think it ultimately boiled down to a lack of quality. But I don't know, I found myself really on the side of Canada. I really wanted them to win because I felt their performance deserved something. Really bold and brave. Like you said, a couple of decisions went against them. I mean, have you seen that clip of Yuri Tielemans just falling down when Alphonso Davies goes past him? I mean, I'm sure Mikel Arteta will be screaming at the TV for that and saying, get him off the scout list at this second. And he was hooked at halftime because they were just killing them in midfield. I mean, they brought on Onana, who's at Everton now, just to give them a bit of presence because they couldn't get anywhere near the ball. But like you said, Canada will be kicking themselves, although Belgium, you know, had the bit of quality through Batshuayi and a few other chances on the break, that the final ball was just awful. I mean, awful, awful, awful. De Bruyne, you know, Hazard rushing things, inaccurate passing. Really frustrating.
I mean, I'm shocked to find out that Eden Hazard still plays football, let's be honest. Like,
and the Roberto Martinez still coaches.
Yeah, that's a good point. Is Thierry Henry still involved with this setup?
Yeah, I think he is.
And
he
Thomas Vermaelen. Thomas Vermaelen's on their coaching setup as well.
They might be a better 5-a-side team than 11-a-side. Phil mentioned how old they looked and playing with that back three. I couldn't believe they didn't change it. Like, they were being outdone everywhere. They're like, Canada played this front three that pressed the back three and completely pinned them in the first half. And like Phil mentioned earlier, the Japan coach, seeing all that space that Germany were getting out wide, they decided to change it. It changed the game. And Roberto Martinez saw whatever he saw in the first half and went, all right, lads, same again.
Run it back.
Madness. Absolute madness.
Lewis, I mean, do you... Like, on one of the talking points going into this tournament is, can the golden generation ride off into the sunset with the World Cup having really underachieved to the extent that it's hard, right? Because there's a tournament every 2 years, and if you don't win it, you've underachieved, and then your golden generation's gone. It's pretty harsh, but that's the way international football works. Just ask Pessy. But like, I can't help myself. But like, Belgium do not look like they have any chance of making noise in this tournament as it stands. They looked old. They looked slow. They still have some quality. I mean, on the day, if De Bruyne hits his best form, he's still a player I think that can win you a game by himself. He's that good. He didn't have that today. But looking at the way they ran in transition, they have no chance. The irony is, like, I don't know why it should surprise us that a Roberto Martinez coach team doesn't look great defensively, because he's been comedically bad at that for a long time. But I wonder if you're where I am. I'm ready to write them off. Is it too soon?
I think they're really bad. I think, you know, golden generation. Is it? Like, it was
it
four
was.
Years ago.
It was.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Like, but that moment for that team was 4 years ago, if they were ever going to put the run together. And they went far. Semifinals 4.5 years ago? Eden Hazard's done nothing for a few years.
At the USA's expense.
Yeah. I mean, mm-hmm. like, you know, Eden Hazard's done nothing for a few years. Romelu Lukaku, hasn't done much for a couple of years and has been injured since, I think his last start for Inter was in August or September. So he wasn't even on the bench today. Even if he got fit enough to feature at some point, you can't really rely on him playing. Mm. I mean, they're still playing Carrasco at wing back. The Phil mentioned the centre halves are all old. It's basically, you know, Courtois and De Bruyne who are both world class and can, you know, when I say it like that, I'm like, but if you've got Courtois and De Bruyne on your day, you can probably beat anyone. But
well, this is a crazy thing. It beat one of Morocco or Croatia and you're through. And then it's who knows, right? I mean, it's knockout at that point, and like it could go nil-nil all the way to penalties.
So bad. They played, like, no disrespect to Canada, because Canada were brilliant, and I don't want to take that away.
And they were in qualifying. They were in qualifying. Let's make no mistake. That team was very good in qualifying as well.
We shouldn't talk about it like, and the same like with Japan earlier. We shouldn't talk about it like, oh, it was only Canada or anything. But Canada are not Spain, and they're not Brazil, and they're not Argentina, and they're not France, and they're not England. And if Canada can make Belgium look that uncomfortable, then teams with that level of quality in every single position could just rip Belgium apart, I think, if they come up against them. I think every other team that's considered sort of in the running would look at that Belgium performance tonight and be very, very happy to play them next.
Hey, I'm sorry, eh? If you think we're not England or Germany or France, eh? Oh, I'm sorry, but you know we're not just maple syrup, eh? We can play some football. Is how a Canadian person.
I didn't know Scotland qualified for the World Cup.
You know what? I am great at accents. Just ask me to do any accent, and I'll do it. And I can do a Canadian accent because I spent years going to Canada, like every 3 weeks for work. I've spent a lot of time in Toronto and Mississauga area, and I do love Canada. And
we are going to bring you up again over the next few weeks on ask me to do any accent, and I'll do it.
I mean, firstly, you can't, because that gets you probably canceled, but also like I'm so bad at them. Like, I feel like I can do Canada though, because Canada and America are like, you know, we're besties, we're neighbors, can do that. I wouldn't venture into too many. I mean, I'll do an English accent, obviously, because that one's just very easy, and not a problem for me whatsoever. So anyway, let's move on as swiftly as possible. Okay, well, that leaves the teams that will be looking at that game and wondering, maybe we can get past Belgium, maybe we can't get past Canada. If you're Morocco or Croatia, who got a 0-0 draw at 4 a.m. my time, a game that I saw a total of 0 minutes and 0 seconds of, you may have been looking at this group saying, it's the first game and it's the Canada game, and if we can get something from those, we're through. Now you may be seeing Belgium as a chance and Canada as trickier, but did anyone, Lewis, impress you in Morocco 0, Croatia 0?
Genuinely, no.
5-8. I mean, you know, a classic of the genre. Anything to write home about there? Any talking points? Was Modric still Modric? What do we got?
I mean, yeah, that's the thing. The players that we know and that we think are great were probably not quite as good as we know they can be. When you get to international level and you have a few star players, a lot of these teams have to maybe two or three star players, and when they aren't having a good day, then becomes a quite a low quality game of football. And I think that's what we saw with Morocco as well, with, you know, Hakim Ziyech and Ashraf Hakimi. Neither of them were really on it, and the same goes for Modric and Croatia. So yeah, I don't know if Phil has anything more interesting than that to say about that game, but
just to give you an idea of how
you didn't miss anything
of how old Modric is. He's almost Ronaldo's age, Phil. That's how old he is. So kudos to him for still playing. I mean, you read this Croatia team and you're like, that guy still plays? Oh, that guy still plays? Oh, wow, they have that. He's still playing. Like, it's never a good sign when you thought half the team retired. You know, Ziyech is 29, which is, you know, in my book, he might as well be 50, age curve, totally done, can't play, probably should retire. Anything of interest from this game? I guess, you know, maybe it's just the case that because it was played at 4 a.m., they weren't awake yet. Oh, no, wait, it wasn't that time locally. Okay, next excuse. What's the reason this game stunk so bad?
No, I think it was just two teams cancelling each other out. I mean, to be fair, there wasn't a bad midfield battle. I think Croatia are obviously strongest there in midfield, but Morocco held their own. I thought Sofia and Amrabat was really good in the first half. But ultimately, Morocco were looking to a couple of players to try and give them something. And as Lewis said, Ziyech overhit a couple of crosses. Hakimi couldn't quite get into the game in an attacking sense. Mazraoui is a really good player, but he got injured. You know, it was just kind of very first game in the group vibes with nobody really willing to commit to win the game in fear of losing. And I think both of them are still sitting in a promising position in terms of what they want to do, which is qualify. But this game was not anything to write home about. I mean, it was all set pieces and a couple of good recovery tackles from Josko Gvardiol. But other than that, it was, you know, get a point on the board and we go on to the next one.
Yeah, and I think like the being happy to take a point, you saw that with Morocco not bringing on Ilyas Cher, who has been really, really good for QPR in the Championship this season. And I wouldn't be surprised at all to, you know, when the pressure's on a little bit more to get a result and they're going to have to win one of the last two, at least one of the next two games. I hope that we see him because I think he'll liven their game up a bit as well.
Well, let's look ahead to tomorrow. So it's interesting. We get our first look at three teams that may have designs on going deep: Uruguay, Portugal, and Brazil. Switzerland also plays, so Granit Xhaka is in to the tournament. I guess this is interesting because it's a day where each of the four games have a team that will have targeted that game probably as the one they need to win, so to speak. You know what I mean? Like, Portugal plays Ghana, Brazil plays Serbia, Uruguay plays South Korea, and Switzerland plays Cameroon. They're all going to feel like we need something here, given that they have someone in their group that they will have an eye on. Now, Brazil, I think, probably will feel like they can beat everyone every time they come up against them, but Switzerland's certainly going to pose them problems. Portugal will look at Uruguay, and Uruguay will look at Portugal and see them as their biggest problem. So everybody's kind of got to announce themselves tomorrow. Let's start quickly, Lewis, with Brazil. I mean, to me, they're the favorites. They're always the favorites. I think they're more so the favorites in this tournament, but we've seen France look pretty good despite their injuries. We've seen Spain look dominant. Are we going to see a France that deserves to be favorites in, admittedly, a tricky game against Serbia?
I really hope we get a close game. Before we were recording, me and Phil were talking, and we'd said like a lot of these games have been kind of one-sided. And today we finally got two really, really close games, hard-fought games. Went with the favourite, one went against the favourite. Mm-hmm. And I think Serbia-Brazil tomorrow has our best chance of that sort of continuing. I think Serbia are going to be really, really tough to play against. So I'm hoping
that front line, Vlahovic and Mitrovic, are going to beat some people up, right? I mean, like that, you're not going to be able to rest.
Tadic and Kostic providing them as well. So I think and I hope Serbia are going to surprise a few people this next couple of weeks or this next week, depending how long they stay in the competition. And yeah, I don't think there'll be pushovers. I think Brazil are going to have to really work for all 3 points.
I think, yeah, every time you get a set piece, if you're Serbia, you're going to be putting that ball in the mixer. And with Mitrovic and Vlahovic,
those Brazil defenders are all leaving the pitch with bruises.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, what about Uruguay? I mean, Phil, that's a team that I think a lot of people have looked at as a potential dark horse. I'm not sure that's right or not right. But like, Uruguay just always seemed like a difficult out. Everyone knows what I thought about Darwin Nunez from a sort of technical level, but he's in good form for his club. He can run in behind and cause all kinds of problems. Luis Suarez still there, still kicking around. Betancourt, unfortunately, has been in good form for a team that shall remain nameless. Are Uruguay going to get out of the blocks fast and impress us as a possible dark horse in this tournament?
Well, they're my dark horses from the preview podcast. I mean, look.
I thought that was Denmark.
That's Lewis. Lewis's team was Denmark.
And how did that go for you in match day one? No, go ahead. Sorry.
Early days.
You know, we spoke about some teams looking old and some players getting old, and I don't think it gets much older than Uruguay with Luis Suarez, Edison Cavani, and Diego Godin in the team. But I don't know. I've just got a little feeling about them. They always can band something together. I mean, they're a tiny nation full of fire and fight, and they'll stop at nothing to win, as we've seen several times over the years. And I don't know. I've just got a little feeling that they'll be very hard to break down, very committed, and then just have a bit of magic up front. And I think in terms of South Korea, you know, very neat and tidy team in possession. They've got obviously one huge danger man up front, which is Son. They've got an excellent defender in Kim Min-jae. But if I'm looking at anybody to win tomorrow, it's Uruguay. So I think all four fixtures look super fun, actually. It's going to be a really fun day to watch. You know, even Portugal, Ghana, you've got a lot of talent on that pitch. So I'm strapped in, I'm ready, and I'm ready for Uruguay to bring home the 3 points.
Do you need to be strapped in, or can you just sit down? Like, is there something we should know about you that requires us to strap
Phil gets very, very excited when he's watching Uruguay. Oh
dear, look, it's Switzerland and Cameroon gets my juices going. Granit Xhaka back in the eight. Oh, I've missed it.
Yeah, well, Granit Xhaka will be making his debut. Last question, Lewis, we'll leave it here. We're not going to go deep on the Switzerland thing, although we will be watching Granit Xhaka with great interest, as always. Is the story of this World Cup for Portugal just whether they can rise above the chaos surrounding Cristiano Ronaldo right now? A lot of times, he seems bigger than his club. In some ways, he seems bigger than his country. And right now, so much news surrounding him. He has literally driven the owners of Manchester United out of the club by being a colossal pain in the ass. Is that really the story for Portugal? Can they rise above the mire, the quagmire that is Cristiano Ronaldo these days?
I'm sure there are people involved in that Portugal camp that wish they could rip his passport up the way that Man United have ripped up his contract. Unfortunately, unlike Man United, they are permanently stuck with him.
Because like, they got talent all over the pitch.
Yeah, I think we'll see the Man United problem. Bruno Fernandes is worse when Cristiano Ronaldo plays. Bernardo Silva will be worse when Cristiano Ronaldo plays. But when Cristiano Ronaldo's there, he causes you so much of a headache if you don't play him that you don't really have a choice. So Portugal are incredibly talented. But I think, we'll see him, as he's done at club level the past few years, hold his teammates back by insisting that the world should continue to revolve around him. What a shame.
Yeah. I mean, Bernardo Silva, Bruno Fernandes, Diogo Jota, Cristiano Ronaldo up front. They have João Felix, who's not, to be fair, in the best form these days. Ruben Neves, Carvalho, Cancelo, who might be one of the best players in the world. Like, it's a supremely talented team. And Phil, if they don't go far in this tournament, you do wonder, especially if it feels like it's been influenced by the Ronaldo drama, and if he throws a strop on the pitch and gets mad because Fernandes didn't find him with a pass and something happens and it doesn't go well for them. You wonder, can a man like that tarnish his legacy at this point, or is he someone who's destined to just always be viewed as a deity among footballers, both in Portugal and globally? Where do you think we stand with the Ronaldo situation there for a team that otherwise, without him, would certainly be getting talked up as one of the favorites, I think?
I don't think he's going to tarnish his legacy, but I do think people are realizing very quickly his intentions and it's his interest, which is very much Cristiano Ronaldo and nobody else. He spoke about being the captain, wanting to take responsibility for his team, and he did that unorganized press conference and spoke about, I speak when I want and I want my teammates to be focused on the game and not about me, when all you've done is just draw more attention to yourself in the last few days. So look, I think there'll be some words being said behind the scenes. I said it in the preview pod, Portugal have big crash and burn potential in this tournament, and it wouldn't surprise me. I think Fernando Santos is a very negative coach. And I can see that talent going to waste, and I would love every second of it. Apologies to any Portuguese people. But yeah, that's how I see it. And maybe they'll have to oust him to get the best out of the others.
Was this the best day of the tournament so far, just in your view, by the way? Maybe because the 4 a.m. game passed me by, but I loved the other three games.
I think in general, yeah. I think we had a big shock yesterday. But in terms of the overall score lines and games, I think today was great. It's starting to feel like a World Cup as much as it can. It's still not the same, but I enjoyed today.
Okay. I did too. Let's leave it there. We will have more tomorrow because, as it says in the name, this is the World Cup Daily. And we will certainly see what happens with some Titans taking the pitch. Should be a fun day of narrative and hopefully football as well. Lewis is on Twitter at LG Ambrose. Thanks, Lewis.
Thank you. Until tomorrow.
Until tomorrow. Phil's on Twitter at _PhilCosta. Thanks, Phil.
Thank you.
Be remiss if I didn't wish the Americans listening a very happy Thanksgiving. I hope you have a safe, healthy, and wonderful Thanksgiving with family and friends, and eat whatever kind of food you like. Don't be bullied into eating turkey just because they tell you that's what you're supposed to eat. We are having ham. But that's enough of that. I will be watching football, but not the kind that Americans usually watch on Thanksgiving. I'll be watching the real football, soccer, right? In the World Cup, and then recording the World Cup daily as you do on a family day. Love you. We'll talk to you after. Oh, we almost got it, by the way. We almost got the York. If you're Spanish, you almost got the Your Country 10 of the Country 10. We love you. We'll talk to you after Your Country 10 of the Country 10.